property. These are really pressing issues. Why is it that this Judaism, which seems, yes, divine, but also quite human, is something that has to be adhered to when we feel that the people who constructed it don't reflect my mindset? Let's start with the Rabbi Cardozo and move forward.
Well, first of all, I would say that I do not believe that there is such a thing as objective truth. And I neither believe that Chazal had that. But that doesn't take away from the authority of Chazal. I even believe, although this is a very sensitive issue, and I'm aware of that, and I've had loads of discussions, and I'm not out of it myself yet, is Chazal probably made mistakes. However, we have to realize one thing. What they are required to do, and I think they did it better than anybody else was, they were looking for the truth, and they did anything in their lives to find it. They did the optimal what you can do under the circumstances with the best brains in the world, Leshem Shamayim, with a lot of Yirat Shamayim. They came to certain conclusions. At that moment we are being told, and that is what it means, Torah lo ba shamayim hi. At that moment we have to agree with them, we have to go along, as long as we don't have a very good argument, and it has to be really good, which I wonder if we have anything like that today, which would say, no, here we really have to disagree and we have to move in an other direction. I doubt, I can only speak about myself, but I suppose that all of us have this feeling as well, is do we have that not just intellectual, but also moral objectivity, that we are of such tremendous religious standing that we now are able to dispute Chazal when we are not on their level. So we have to be careful. We have to admit that they sometimes made mistakes. On the other side, who am I to stand up against a ruling of theirs, unless I have an halachic way of doing that, which is another issue, but if I cannot, then I don't think we should do that, because that's the meaning of Torah lo bashamayim here. The Torah is subjective to the mind of human beings, and these human beings were great human beings, I think, greater than we are today, therefore I will have to listen to them. However, on the other side, the moment that there are issues, like for example the Agunah problem, and things like that, where Chazal did show us possibilities of finding solutions, and some poskim are refusing to make use of that, that's already a different story. Then I would say we must make use of that, because Chazal did give us the opening.
I feel that the only answer has to be a very nuanced and sophisticated one. There are many truths. There's artistic truth, there's scientific truth, there's historical truth, and there's halachic truth. Halachic truth is not the same as historic truth, and it's not the same as scientific truth. Where Chazal were not speaking of halacha, they were speaking about, you know, they were people of Torah Amada. They knew the world. And when they were speaking about things in the world, they may have been mistaken. Look, they believe that the sun revolves around the earth. They believed a whole bunch of things. You know, they have all kinds of medicine in Chazal. But the Gaonim had an isur. They prohibited Jews from following the medicine of the Gemara because they were wrong. And it was discovered later that there. And there's nothing, it doesn't bother my emunah one little bit. Because that's not what Chazal are all about. In a literature as enormous as the Talmud, you'll find many references to items which our knowledge has increased over the generations. Tosfos writes frequently, Nishtanu ha'itim, that Nishtana ha'teva, nature changed. What they meant is our understanding of nature has changed, and therefore certain changes took place. Where they have a halacha based on wrong knowledge, there we follow the halacha. That's halachic truth. Example, an idea of treifas. What disqualifies an animal, makes it from kosher to treif? There is one kind of treifa that it's not accurate scientifically. The Rambam talks about it. The Rambam says, afal pikein, that's none of our business. Because the Torah is not giving us a lesson in animal husbandry or an animal anatomy or biology. Torah gave us halachas, we follow them. If it is based on a mistake that Chazal knew about or accepted, it makes no difference. We have the tradition, we must keep it. The one who deals with this to a great extent is the introduction to the Chassos HaChoshen, the introduction of Rav Moshe Feinstein to his Igros Moshe. Halachic truth is a truth in its own right. So we accept it not because it tells us about science, it tells us about the real world. We accept it because this is Torah Mir HaShemayim. And even if they are mistaken, then the Rebbe Shalom and his great wisdom and his great chesed says, don't worry about it. Chazal said it, then as part of the whole Torah, we follow that. So I accept it, but I'm not bothered by the perhaps mistaken science or mistaken realia, because if it's not affecting halacha, I don't accept it at all. If it goes into halacha, I accept the halacha. I don't care if it's mistaken or not. It's the halachic truth.
What happens if the halachic truth radically...
What happens if the halachic truth is radically affecting people's lives in a negative way? In other words, it's all very nice to say, I accept it even if it's mistaken, if one doesn't have a kind of deficit or price to pay for it. But if one does have a price to pay for it...
Well, the only price I can find right now is that certain kinds of tripas you can't eat. I mean, if you're thinking of the Aguna case, I'm not talking about that. That is not a case where Chazal made them and didn't make mistakes. This, there are certain halachas come that is Rabbi Cardoza is right. If we didn't, you know, you mentioned that if we can have economic change, why can't we have halachic change and Aguna? Very simple. Economic change we have because Chazal linked it to the marketplace. It was the way the industry standard. They said it openly. And therefore, you're dealing with mammonis, with money. With money, you can make a mistake, because if it's a mistake, you can give it back. When it comes to arayas, when it comes to affecting the heritage and lineage of families, you're dealing about sexual morals, they don't play games. And therefore, you cannot treat the Aguna problem as easily as you can the economic problem. Doesn't mean we're doing enough. No, we're not doing enough. Everyone, unfortunately, a plague of our generation is that everyone looks over his right shoulder. It's about time we did it this way, you know. Look over our left shoulder. We shouldn't even look over our shoulders. We should look too straight on the face. But the fact is, it's a very difficult problem. It's not easy. Berkowitz himself devised certain solutions. And I'm not sure, I think halachically he was correct, but I'm not sure that when many of the Gedolim disagreed with him about his particular plan of giving conditional marriage, they disagreed because they felt that conditional marriage for every, you know what he said? Everyone should get married al tanai, on condition that if there's any problem, the marriage is dissolved retroactively. But that means that everyone who's married grows up with a feeling that his or her marriage is kind of wobbly, is conditional. And who knows if you're going to come into an argument with your husband or your wife 20 years from today, and the Bezin will say it's finished, then you've been living, I don't want to use the word living in sin, it's a very goyish concept. But you've not been living together properly. It just is not good for the health of the family. And they felt that this is a worse problem than the Aguna problem.
Well, since you've put women on the table, I think we should talk a little bit about that. And you can get full shot here.
I just want to make a more. Okay. I want to comment on this question, just very brief comment, past question. I agree with Rabbi Lam about the halachic truth being different. You know, if you have a bezdin, two people say one way, one person says the other way, that doesn't prove the fact. I mean, what if that doesn't prove the objective fact. It's just the halacha. So that's not really, at that point, we don't really need to discover what the fact is. We need to know what the halacha is. But you said Chazal can make a mistake. I think they can make a mistake, and it's a valid question when it regards the orbit of the Earth and the Sun, the things like that. But you're saying sociological issues.
Or psychological issues,
you know, I would say that their wisdom was superior to ours, and I don't think that Chazal underestimated the intellectual capacity of women, as you said. So I just want to go on record that
their
wisdom
perfect,
don't accept that. God's wisdom is perfect, but it's superior to ours. And if we say they made a mistake, that means that our wisdom is superior to theirs on issues which are not scientific, and I don't accept that.
So the idea, let's say that...
They had women in those days, too.
And they
had an equal number of grandmothers and grandfathers.
But was their perception of women the same as, say, mine would be? I've grown up in... some ways in my professional life, in an academic setting, where I see women who are incredibly gifted, skillful, brilliant, inspiring, passionate on just a variety of grounds, both intellectual and spiritual. And it raises for me the issue of statements like, Horezi Tiflut, and so on. So I'm wondering if one can look at some of the statements that the sages are making vis-a-vis women, and this, I guess, segues into a kind of... question on women. Many Orthodox women, I think I want to cut right to the chase here, have heard the kinds of explanations that have been given to them about why they should accept the kinds of divisions that Orthodoxy makes for them. I guess the most popular is separate but equal, and so on. And a lot of women have heard that talk and still clamor for more. In other words, don't necessarily abide by the picture that you give in your book or that you gave this morning in your lectures. I'm wondering, how would you respond to such women? Is their desire, let's say, for certain kinds of equal worship, certain kinds of spiritual expression, certain kinds of intellectual possibility, even in terms of Talmudic learning, something in which they are just wrongly rebelling against the way we do things in Judaism, or is it actually a kind of new wave that suggests a new world and is actually l'chadchila a good thing?
Yes, me?
Go.
I don't think that women are inferior in any way. I think women are as smart or smarter than most men. I think that if a woman was running for president of the United States, as far as I'm concerned, that would be a plus. I think we'd be less likely to get into stupid wars. I think that in the Middle East, the problems in the Arab world would be solved if they had women's rights. That it's too much of a male-dominated society, and I think that if the women had rights and women had an equal position in society, that everything would be much improved. We're talking over here about, I mean, you said about what I spoke in the book and what I spoke about this morning. I really can't get into that again within the 90 seconds that you're going to give me before you cut me off. But all I'm saying is that the reason that women today, and you know, women are free to do whatever they want. The Torah does not forbid them to go to pursue any kind of career, do anything they want. But the reason why certain women are clamoring for more participation in the shul or in ritual is because they don't feel the fulfillment in what women traditionally have felt fulfillment. Last week, I got an email from a Gioris. She writes to me while she was considering conversion to Judaism, everybody was, and she's Orthodox, so everybody was telling her, what are you, crazy? What are you going to go become an Orthodox woman? You know what's going to be? And you know, you're going to be a second-class citizen, you'll be nothing. And she writes to me, and she has terrible misgivings, but she decided to do it anyway. And she said that she is extremely happy with it, that she feels tremendous fulfillment in preparing a Shabbos and in getting ready to build a Jewish home. And she says she feels tremendous respect from Tznius and Shomer Nagia. And she's extremely happy. So I think that it's all a question of societal influences, and people are feeling the inadequacy and lack of fulfillment. But I don't think that the basic structure is wrong. I think it's right.
Nobody argues the basic structure is wrong. I'm just wondering if it isn't a tad patronizing to tell women that this is the only domain you should be happy with.
Women are entitled to pray as much as they like. They can take out an Oscar and go more if they want to learn it. But it's not part of the system to invest the efforts of society to train people to be Talmudic scholars.
I'll go after you.
The difference, and I'm harking back to an earlier question, the difference, if you want it, between progressive Judaism and Orthodox Judaism is a difference in approach to Chazal. The approach of progressive Judaism is one of revisionism, where we look at Chazal as something that can be critiqued and changed, analyzed, tweaked to suit the needs of a modern time. The approach of Orthodox Judaism is one of transmission, where the Chazal had transmitted through a chain of transmission dating back, if you have to look at Pirkei Avos and the Rambam in his introduction to Sefer Mitzvahs, where we go through the chain of transmission between then all the way through to now. And our approach to Chazal is that we are another link in the chain. By us critiquing Chazal, we are now creating a new chain. Now, that's, if you want, the broad picture. It has its limitations. One of the limitations is certain approaches to ritual.
There are other limitations. I'm going to mention one which is a very curious limitation, one which has been approached in various periods of halachic examination. That's the one of kipnius on Pesach. There was a time when kipnius was forbidden because of its association with wheat and barley. It wasn't forbidden in the Sephardi world. Today we no longer buy wheat and barley together with beans and other pulses. And yet we are still forbidden, absolutely forbidden, to eat pulses on Pesach. It's the same as eating chomet. Now that's an anomaly. It makes no sense. Another one is Yom Tov Sheni. Why do we keep second day Yom Tov? We all know that Yom Tov, we've worked out the calendar, we know the days of Yom Tov, so why do we keep Yom Tov Sheni? Out of respect for Chazal. I make one other point. That is that the Gemara is full of arguments. The entire Talmud is full of arguments. If you're going to say that we entirely respect the word of Chazal, then what about all the people who we don't agree with and whose halacha we don't follow? What about all the Beis Shammais that we disagree with? What about all the Abayas that we disagree with? Or we pass in like Rava? And the fact is that following Chazal, we're following a chain of transmission that has been given to us. This is the way we follow the Jewish tradition. As I said, that has its limitations. That has its short circuits. But those short circuits are very much a part of our tradition. And if you buy into orthodoxy, if you buy into traditional observant Judaism, you're buying into that chain of transmission. The moment you start tweaking it, the moment you start playing around with it, that's when you make the leap from being a traditional orthodox Jew to being a progressive Jew. It doesn't matter if you call that conservative, reconstructionist, reform. In England, you have liberals of all types. It makes no difference. That is the one defining term that separates us as Orthodox Jews and progressive Jews.
Yes, I disagree with many of the things that Rabbi Dunner said, but I don't want to talk about that, and I want to get back to our conversation. You said that
what a shame.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll come back to you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you said that separate but equal with a certain, an intellectual sneer. As if separate but equal is, you know, I don't believe that the United States Supreme Court has to be our arbiter in Posek Acharon in how we live our Judaism. They said separate but equal is essentially unequal. Fine. You know, if Bush makes two more appointments at the Supreme Court, they may turn the whole thing over. I mean, they're not really the ones who have to set our I believe is separate but equal. And therefore, I do not believe in the inequality, but I believe in separation. That's why we have a separate mechitza, we have a separate halachas. And it doesn't faze me the least bit. I'll tell you something else. Are you a Kohen? If you were a Kohen, you would be able to get Truma and Mises, and you'd be able to give a blessing, and I can't. Do I feel inferior? No, because the Torah has hierarchy built into it. The Yisrael, Kohen, Levi, there are all various categories, and that's part of the whole tradition.
But these are categories that were constructed. No, I've heard this for years.
Said it for the first time.
These are categories that were constructed by people. If somebody said to you, I'm going to decide for you that your role is separate but equal. And it's one thing for there to be a kind of communal assent to it. But I think what women resent is the notion that I will tell you what your separation and your equality is about. And excuse me if we use the word patriarchal in that context. But if I'm going to play devil's advocate here, I'm going to play it all the way. And I have to say quite honestly that I am in sympathy with that rejection. It's one thing to talk about, you have your role and I have my role. Who decided that?
Who decided that
this should be enforced on other people?
A tradition that is 3,000 years old.
No,
let me
you know it.
Okay. You're playing the devil's advocate too well. You're so many devils.
Many have said that before. Yeah.
You know, if I feel that someone who is a greater Talmud Chacham than I, which is not a great accomplishment, I have to stand up when he enters the room. Who tells me to do that? He tells me that? You tell me that? No. A tradition of 3,000 years tells me to do it. A woman says to me, oh, this is white, male, European dominated. I say, that's nonsense. This goes back to the Asian Minor, it's not European, and it's not male-dominated. It's a tradition that comes down. Does it have certain inequalities? Yes. My answer is, I have to weigh which is more important. The minor annoyance that comes to you or me or her or him, or preserving the most sacred tradition known to mankind. I vote for tradition. Now,
You also you decide way, what's a minor annoyance to other
finish.
People.
You can. I know. Yeah, okay. I when doing this. I'm not telling him to do this.
But in other words, the kinds of words we use finish. Here are.
Okay. I want to get back to the role of women. Having said that I accept separate but equal, and I probably will shock Rabbi Ryman, I believe very important that women who want to study Gemara should have an opportunity to do it, not by some on a Xerox copy of the daf, but in the daf. We have a program now at Stern College, but not of Stern College, where young women who have graduated college can learn as if they were in a kollel for 2 years and they get paid for it. And their learning is done with every Reb Chaim that comes across in the sugya. They learn well, they make leinen. I know I have my granddaughter in that group. I was shocked. I wanted to learn with my uncle, who was a great educator. And he talked to my granddaughter, and she said, "Can we learn together?" He said, "You mean in a Gemara?" She said, "Yes." He said, "I can't do it." "Why?" "I don't know. I just can't do it." I had to respect his feelings. I can do it. She's my chavrusa. No, shock of shocks. But you know, when I asked her, why do you...
Speechless.
When I... and that takes something.
I doubt it.
When I asked... When I said to her, "Tova, do you want to become a rabbi?" She was furious. She said, "Zaida, you insult me. You see, you think that's why I'm doing this?" I said, "Well, what then are you doing? You're spending so much time learning Gemara." I mean, she made CM on 3 Masechtas already. I said, "Why are you doing this?" She said, "Because you taught me all my life that the greatest form of Avodas Hashem is learning Torah. Why deny it to me?" So we have a whole group of people who are becoming Talmidei Chachamim, and Yer HaShemayim, second to none, she doesn't miss a mincha a single day.
Certainly narrows her choices in marriage.
That's a different story. But thank God she's getting engaged to a fine Talmidei Chacham. 3 weeks from today.
I just want to add something to this, which I haven't worked out myself yet, and I just throw it here on the to the other speakers. The question which I am bothered by is, when Chazal would have lived today, would they still have made that statement that learning Torah is tiflis? In other words, is the Gemara making a sociological statement at the time, which when afterwards was stated in the Rambam as an halacha? Or are we dealing here indeed with an halacha le Moshe Me Sinai, and there's therefore little what we can do about it? Or Chazal saying, listen, at the time in which we lived, there was this issue of tiflis, and at that time it applied. And what I would like to link it up with is an other matter. We are going through, we have always been, but lately in the last 50, 60 years, we have gone through an incredible change of everything. Our whole, indeed, women have now opportunities which they had never before. That is also min hashamayim. It is not just something purely secular. We believe that history is moved by Hashem and that therefore changes take place also concerning the way how women relate to their religiosity. So the question then is, when the posek would have to deal with this, he will, in my personal opinion, at least that's the way how I see it at this moment, is this needs to be taken into account to give a psak din about these matters. Right? Who says that Chazal would indeed have said this today? That doesn't mean to say that we disagree with Chazal. No, Chasper Shalom. What we are saying is that Chazal said that at that time because then it was applicable. Now, I know there's a danger there because we have to be very careful that we don't apply that everywhere and anywhere. We are in the conservative movement, and that's the last thing which I obviously don't want to do. But I think we should rethink over, and Poskim should think over, what are exactly the gedarim, the borderlines here, so to allow a certain change taking place without really having to deviate from halachic standards and still allow for different possibilities halachically without ever having to say that Chazal made a mistake a long time ago.
But this idea of tiflis, of teaching a woman Torah is like teaching her immorality, is the opinion of only one Tana.
That's
Rebeleza.
On top of it.
But Ben Azai and Abaya all disagreed.
Right.
They all disagreed. And
right.
There were many women, the daughters of Rashi and the daughters of Ishai and Pig, and others who were great Talmidei Chachamim.
Right.
But it wasn't widespread. Today everything is different, as you
right.
say.
Yeah, sure.
But I don't think it's Allah Halam Hashem Sinai. And I think
if
Rabbi Elazar were alive, his daughter would be going
Sinai
to that program.
I'm sure all of these good people have many questions they'd like to ask you, so I'm just going to throw one last one out, and then we're going to open up to the floor.
And it's really more of a kind of fantasy question. There are many other questions we could be asking, but if all of you had unlimited resources and unlimited time, what would you do to revive Judaism? What would you see as the number one change you would make in today's Jewish or Orthodox world? Why don't we start with Rabbi Dunner?
Well, the simple answer is to devote a lot more time to postgraduate young Jews. And the reason I say that is because it's at the stage of life where most young Jewish people are beginning to build the or construct the life which they're going to lead for the next 40 or 50 years. When they're at home, in school, high school, and even when they go to university, their life is more or less on autopilot. Unless they're going to be unlucky and get involved in a scene which is going to drag them away from it, they're more or less going to be kept on a straight and narrow, especially if they come from a middle-class Jewish background. And of course, there's a lot of programs which are aimed at those age groups. School program in this country, you've got all types of school programs and Hillel programs and educational programs which aim at Jews. I think that where there's an enormous hemorrhage of Jews is the postgraduate age, and it's also the hardest group of Jewish people to reach. I'm speaking here from experience. I set up my synagogue 6 years ago in London specifically with this age group in mind, and despite the enormous amount of negative predictions, was very successful in attracting those people to a shul and to all types of programs, cultural, educational, Torah-oriented, Jewish-oriented, social-oriented programs, and with enormous success rates of people marrying to the Jewish faith and people involving themselves in Jewish life in ways that they never thought possible. I think that the problem is, you said about unlimited resources, you need limitless resources with that age group, because these are people who are not going to be palmed off with paper plates and a plastic tablecloth on a Friday night with two pieces of kugel. These are people more sophisticated, who are already in highly paid jobs, who are building up their lives, and you're going to need a lot of very attractive programming and educated programmers to get them to involve themselves in Jewish life. If you're going to build Jewish life for the future in America and the Western world, it's going to be through the postgraduate age group of 22 to 35.
Well, the question is, if I had unlimited time and unlimited resources, if I had unlimited time, I would try to figure out an answer what to do with the unlimited resources. If I have to give a limited time and give you an answer immediately, I would say the unlimited resources should be to make a total revaluation and reconstruction of Jewish education in the world. That there should be no charge of Schar Limud. Every parent should be sent a child to elementary school, high school, college, even graduate school, free. And teachers should have their salaries doubled, and half the teachers should be fired. Because we have to get very good teachers. If you have the children and you have devoted, competent teachers who don't have to worry where the next meal is coming from or get four jobs to be able to sustain their family, we create a revolution. And I'm only slightly disagree with Rabbi Dunner.
Again?
Focus, again. That's because I agree with you on so many things. We have to highlight those that disagree with.
That's all I understand.
You're speaking about the postgraduate. I have found that that religiously the most sensitive age is probably from 16 to 20. When they're in advanced high school, their minds are beginning to grow and blossom. And that's when they ask questions that no adult asks, very few. They ask, what is the reason I'm in the world? Where does the world come from? What is the meaning of existence? They ask the most profound philosophical questions that most adults, even teachers, are generally not competent to answer, because it's been years since we asked those questions as youngsters. We have to be able to work with that age group, concentrating on them, and then go on further. But that, I think, is the single most important thing for us to do.
Okay. How unlimited is unlimited? Like, really unlimited?
Unlimited,
okay. There are two different answers that were given by Rabbi Dunner and Rabbi Lam. Rabbi Dunner was speaking about how to reach non-Orthodox people. Rabbi Lam was speaking more, I think, within the Orthodox
world.
No,
every Jew and every Jew
and,
in America.
And you think that if you made tuition free, they would all come? I hope.
No, but many more would come.
Okay, very good.
Rabbi Tyson, Rabbi Tyson, Elizabeth.
I am in full agreement with you on that. At least up until the graduate school level.
Yeah.
Okay.
No,
but as far as what I would do, I think that the answer, the best answer, you know, you find in the Arsa Meach experience when they bring in somebody, they don't talk philosophy, and they don't talk ideology. They talk Bava Metzia. They open up a Gemara, they sit down and learn, and the Arsha by Mazir on the Mutav, the most powerful, most effective way to bring people back is to learn Torah with them. And I think that's what could bring back all the non-from Jews is to learn Torah with them in a meaningful way. But how do you do that? How do you do that? So what am I going to do with, how much unlimited time am I going to need to learn with everyone? But how do you do that? So there is something called partners in Torah, where they arrange that an Orthodox person learns Torah on a telephone or in person with somebody from the non-Orthodox world. But that's very limited and very small. What I would do is I would expand that tremendously. Instead of having 2,000 available partners, I would have 200,000 or 300,000 available partners. And then, we were just talking fantasy here, right? I would invest unlimited funds in a Madison Avenue campaign. I would run ads on the Super Bowl, and I don't know how this could be done, but if you can get people to buy 60 pairs of $100 shoes, you can get them to do anything. So I would try to get these people to come and to learn Torah. So
you would invest in an ad for partners in Torah on the Super Bowl on television?
On an unlimited way. On television, yes, on television.
I think that's the textbook definition of irony.
On television, yes. On television, on the internet, all over. I think you bring people together, you get them to learn Torah, that will do the job.
Okay, I don't think there's any money left for me.
I spent it all. But there's plenty of time.
I spent it all in the Super Bowl.
I tell you what I would do. I would do five things. But I'm speaking, first of all, from the Israeli perspective, because that's what I deal with. I would like to start in Israel, and I don't know if I should call it by that name, but at the moment I do not have a name, an outreach program for the general Israeli society, not like Orsa Meach, Eshat Torah, or any one of them does this, not by talking down on them in any way, but getting them involved, first of all, in the learning of the mitzvot ben Adam lechavivo. Only those. Why? Because that's the only language, the Shafa Meshutefet, which we have with the secular world. The values of human dignity. And if we would be able to show to the Israelis, married couples, young married couples specifically, around the whole of the country, the beauty of Jewish ethics in the way how you deal with each other, and they would be very impressed by that, and we will not tell them to keep it, or we'll tell them to eat kosher or keep Shabbat, but just on that level, and impress them by that, I'm sure, and I know this a little bit from my own experience as well, including the Israeli army, is that at that moment they say, phew, if this Jewish tradition is so beautiful on the level of the way how you deal with your fellow man, I like to know more about it. If you start on the other side, which we are constantly doing, speaking with them about Shabbos, and not because Shabbos is any less important, or Kashrut, you can't get the majority of Israelis at this moment to get involved because it is a language they don't know. So first of all, I would start spending my millions over there, which obviously requires, and that automatically comes to the second point, is you need a different kind of teacher. We need to create teacher training colleges here where we have people who know how to do that. At the moment, we are extremely limited in that. And like Robert Lamb said before, many teachers are just not well educated enough to do anything like that. I would also like to change the yeshiva curriculum and introduce, at least in most of them, I'm not saying that there is a need for some who are learning Gemara and only Gemara like we do in the traditional yeshivot, in which I learned myself, but when we speak about the larger crowd of people, there is no point, and here I disagree with my neighbor, of learning the whole day Boa Kama, Boa Basra, Boa Metzia, because it does not speak to them. It speaks to a specific kind of person. But what we need to introduce, like I mentioned before, we have to speak about the meaning of being Jewish, the mission of the Jewish people, what is it that we are all about, how do you get inspired. We have to invoke discussions also in the yeshivot. We have to challenge the Bachurei yeshiva that they know. I can tell you from my own experience, Friday night or Shabbos morning, I often have real Bachurei yeshiva sitting at my table, and we discuss Parshat HaShavua, and they quote Gemoras, and they do all sorts of things which they are really very good in. I ask them, how many years did you learn Gemora? Well, I learned a good part of Shas. I've been learning 5, 6, 7 years. Then I ask them another question. Tell me something. If a non-religious Jew would come to you and say to you, why are you religious? What would you say? And I tell you, most of these fine fellows have not a clue how to answer that question, which shows that there's something wrong in the yeshiva system, that they are not able to answer that sort of thing. And you won't get it from Boa Kama, Boa Metzia, Boa Metzia. I'm not saying that it is very influential, it is just not good enough. So I would like to create a different curriculum. Another thing which I would like to add is, but that's something which I don't know what the result of that would be, is I think we should get a much greater discussion in learning Gemara about the hashkafa behind Gemara. We're learning at the moment Gemara purely from the Londes and the halachic perspective. There is a hashkafa, there's a Weltanschauung there, which we have more or less put aside. Agadathis are not discussed at all anymore, nearly in most of the yeshivot, which I think is another thing. And then I would also add to that, I would like to have a program where young, upcoming poskim, right, who get a lot of halachic knowledge and later have to paskin shailos, that they do not lose indeed matters like mission and the perspective of what it means to be Jewish. You can give a psak din in a very small halachic setting, and you may be wrong because you don't see, as they say, the trees from the forest. And it is very important that we introduce that as well, that these people know what it means to be Jewish on a more universalistic level and paskin accordingly.
You're definitely going to need the most money, it seems. The time is very short. Before we take questions, just for a few minutes, because our next session is, I want to, first of all, thank all of these gentlemen. And first of all, ask Michiel if I interrupted you all too much. Let's give them all a hand. Okay. So I'm told, actually, that we really are running late. So I'm gonna tell you like this. The gentleman will be outside. If people want to ask him a question, they can. We're going to have two sessions coming up now. Rabbi Dunner is going to speak about Torah Judaism and religious Zionism, compatibility or conflict. That's in this room. And upstairs, I believe Michael Broyd is going to speak about approaches to inreach and outreach, speaking to both Jews and non-Jews, and we welcome you to stay for all of that. For now, we wish you shalom.
We want to bring you back again. We have to leave something hanging.
Yes, we hope we'll all get you to come.
We'll be in the back to remind you again. Hey, please fill out your evaluation form. Very important. I'll reiterate again. Take a 5-minute break, and we'll be starting in 5 minutes. Thank you. That was...